Hey, I'm Zach.
And I'm Michael Walsh.
And you're listening to the Landmark Recovery Podcast. There are a lot of podcasts out there that talk about addiction, recovery, and sobriety. But what is unique to us is our network of guests and the stories and information they share.
Yeah, Zach and I not only work in this field, but we're also in recovery ourselves. So we interview medical professionals, therapists, public figures, and also our friends who are willing to come and share their stories with us.
Absolutely. We're going to talk about rock bottoms, rehab, and relapse.
But you'll also hear stories of hope and resilience.
So Mikey, let's go ahead and jump into our next episode.
Hello, everyone. We are continuing to discuss health and wellness in the month of March, and I am excited to introduce a personal friend of mine who you may already be familiar with, especially if you're a football fan. But before we get started, I want to let you know a little bit about Landmark Recovery. This podcast is a production of Landmark Recovery, which is a growing network of treatment centers rapidly opening addiction inpatient treatment around our country. Our mission is to save 1 million lives in the next 100 years from the vicious cycle of addiction. And part of that is to change the landscape of mental health care in America. Guess what? That means addressing how incredibly common addiction is and breaking down stigmas that surround it. Our mental health as individuals and as a country depends on it. With that being said, today I'll be interviewing Randy Grimes. Randy is a former professional football player whose career spanned 10 years with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Randy spent 20 years battling an addiction to painkillers, an addiction he developed while treating career-related injuries. He now uses his inspiring story of recovery in the addiction industry to help victims of drug and alcohol abuse. He's an interventionist and the founding advocate of Pro Athletes in Recovery. Launched in 2012, Pro Athletes in Recovery is a program designed to help athletes of all levels and anyone else find treatment for addiction and mental health while offering continued support for those already in recovery. Due to the success of Pro Athletes in Recovery, Randy has partnered with the NFL, NHL, Gridiron Greats, After the Impact Fund, MLB, Baseball Assistance Fund, the Jockeys Guild, MMA, PGA, LPGA, NBA, and a host of collegiate programs to bring further awareness and treatment services to professional and collegiate athletes and their families. As a result, hundreds of former professional and collegiate athletes, as well as hundreds of non-athletes, have since been treated. Randy's passion does not end with athletes. He is committed to helping all families find balance and peace of mind. Randy believes that when families get well, addicts get well. Randy has performed countless interventions across the U.S. and in 5 countries. Randy has been an exemplary ambassador of the example of the power of professional treatment. Married for 39 years to his college sweetheart, Lydia, who is also a certified family addiction coach, they have 2 children and 4 grandchildren. In addition to these accomplishments, Randy is regularly a commentator on numerous national TV networks and media, including NFL Network, Anderson Cooper, Father Albert, CNN, Fox Sports, MSNBC, Fox News, SiriusXM Sports, New York Times, New York Daily News, Sports Illustrated, and countless others. He has also recently authored a new book, which I've just started, titled Off Center. The book is a memoir of his career and addiction journey. His never give up attitude translates from the gridiron to recovery. Randy, welcome to the show.
Oh, wow. Thank you very much. The show's over now. You just said everything.
If you're anything like me, and I know we have some things in common because I've known you for a while, when I hear people talking about me and reading a bio, I'm like, I feel like they're talking about somebody else.
You know, it's like, I know.
How did I do all that? When I was addicted, I wasn't getting any of that stuff done. And it's amazing. It's, and I've watched you since you get sober, you know, start to kind of put your feet to the pavement, so to speak. And, you know, decade or more later, there's like all this stuff you've been doing. And that's awesome. The other part of it I love is never give up. I mean, you remember my buddy, my mentor, John Southworth. And that's the plaque I have in my office at my house, is a picture of John. And it says, you know, I did a lot of things wrong, but the one thing I did right is I never gave up.
Yeah,
you know, and I was reading the beginning of your book when you're talking about how you take that phone call that first phone call. And there were so many similarities to how I think about when I get a phone call from a family, because as you, I think you said in the book, you know, to them, this is their crisis. They're in the middle of this fire and they just don't know what to do, what to say, what to ask. And to us, unfortunately, it's like we hear this story all day long. And, you know, we want to be empathetic, but also get to the point where we can start to bring some hope to the situation. Can we go back a little bit and talk about, you know, obviously playing at Baylor, you know, playing in high school, you know, the dedication, the work ethic, all of that stuff. You know, so many people, I think that, you know, when you do that, you know, you're not going to become addicted like those other people get addicted. Right. And part of that mindset in competitive sports, it's almost like the military guys that we see trying to get sober. It's, you know, you get taught, you never give up. Like as a hockey player, I was taught, you know, the only thing that I had to do was give everything, you know.
Right.
You don't give up. We might be down 9-0, but I'm not giving up, you know.
Right.
I'm not calling a fighting. How frustrating was it knowing the drugs are killing you in your relationships, but being unable to change it? And how did it get to that point? Like, was it a bright light, or did you see it happening over a long period of time and just, you know, that rationalization that so many of us do, that it's not that bad?
Yeah, well, Mike, I was that guy willing to do whatever I had to stay out on the field. You know, the first real conversation I had with a real pro, you know, somebody that I'd watched on TV. I remember getting into the locker room at One Buck Place, which was our locker room at the Buccaneers. And I had a locker next to Leroy Selman. And the first thing I learned from Leroy was that football was no longer a game. It was now a job, you know. And the second thing I learned from Leroy was you do whatever you have to stay out on that field, because you don't want to get a reputation of always being on the injury report or always missing practice or always in the training room being worked on by the trainers or in line to see the doctor. If you get that reputation, you are sure to have a short NFL career. So you do whatever you have to stay out on the field. And I'm sure Leroy didn't mean taking handfuls of pain pills every day and handfuls of sleeping pills every night to get to sleep. But that's what it eventually grew into for me, you know. And I did. And, you know, we played back in an era, you know, the 80s and early 90s where, you know, we beat the hell out of each other all week long, you know. And then hopefully there was enough left in the tank to play on Sunday. But that was the mentality, you know, that Bear Bryant, Junction Boy mentality, where if you don't practice hard, you're not going to play hard. So a lot of the injuries that we sustained back in the 80s and early 90s were during practice. And it blew my mind that coaches had that philosophy. You know, you would think they'd want to take care of their commodities up until game day, because we were all pros. We were all good. You know, everybody was good that was on that field. Everybody was fast. Everybody was strong. Everybody was smart. And but no, we beat the hell out of each other all week. We beat the hell out of each other for 3 weeks during training camp. And so there were a lot of injuries, and there was a lot of nicks and bruises and swells and different things going on that, you know, I didn't want to let anybody else in my position. You know, I wanted to be out there every snap of every down. And, you know, it progressed. I justified it as a necessary evil. You know, I was getting it from the team doctors or the team trainers or teammates. So, you know, I just thought it was cool. That was the culture. And, you know, I wanted to also be the best center that ever played the game. I wanted to be all pro. I wanted that next fat contract. So those are ways that I wanted to feed my family. Those are ways that I justified it. And, so I never really looked at it for what it really was, which was a full-blown addiction. I looked at it like a necessary evil. And, you know, it progressed to the point to where the last 2 years of my career, I was playing games in complete blackouts. You know, I was the center. I was the quarterback of the offensive line. I was changing blocking schemes. I was getting guys going in the right direction. I was listening to the quarterback to audible. You know, I was listening for the snap count and doing all that in a blackout. You know, I would be home late at night, you know, 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night on a Sunday after playing a 1 o'clock game somewhere in the country or or at home, and I would start coming around, and I'd be all beat up and scratched up and dehydrated, everything you are after an NFL football game that I'd played every down at, and I didn't remember any of it. I was taking so many opiates and benzos before the game that I didn't remember any of it.
It's amazing the power and resilience of the brain that you could not only be getting it knocked around, flooding it with chemicals, and being in these hostile environments and not having an offside or an illegal, you know, every play. You know, that's amazing when you take a step back and think about it. You said something else that really struck me, because I've heard this from athletes, is, you know, it's a job now, it's not a game, and you're trying to feed your family. Literally, you know, what people don't understand is that jump from college to the pros is such a big jump, because, you know, all of a sudden we're not playing for our team, playing for the championship of our league and all that stuff, which is really cool and important. But, you know, we're literally playing for our lives and playing against guys who are playing for their lives, you know. And, you know, that just raises that level of intensity and training. And then, and as you said, add to that practicing against each other. You know, I don't know that we had the knowledge of, you know, what impact on the brain from the concussions and all of that are. I certainly know, and you know, that the medical community either didn't have the information they have today about how harmful these substances were, or they just didn't talk about it, because, you know, you're one of the guys I've heard talk about how easy it was to get when you're in the locker room. I mean, literally some guys have told me about the bowl of, you know, pills in the locker room, and you're just taking them by the handful. And again, you're trying to stay out on the field and feed your family. That, you know, at some point has got to be, again, you wake up and, you know, you don't remember playing in the game. I mean, that's got to be a terrifying feeling.
Yeah, you know,
and you can't tell anybody about it, right?
Oh no. No, you would have to wait and watch it on film. You know, we watched everything on that on 16 8 millimeter film back then, you know, the old splice and everything, splicing film together. But no, we'd have to wait and watch it the next day. But you know what? I always played good, and that just kept it going another week. You know, I can remember in the 8 years this was going on, Mike, nobody ever once came up to me and said, hey, why are you slurring your words? Or why are you nodding off in meetings? Or why are you late to practice every day? Or why are you the last to leave the building every night and pills are missing out of the drug safe? Nobody ever confronted me with that because I was always playing good. You know, we had a drug safe in the middle of our training room that was always wide open. And if it ever was locked, we had three white guys that started on defense, and their jersey numbers were the combination. And like that the whole decade that I was there. But if you didn't get it from the doctors or the trainers or teammates, then you could just go get it yourself. It was full of opiates and benzos. I don't know if you remember Halcyon, but that was the granddaddy of benzos back in the day.
Yeah.
You know, that created a lot of problems for me too. Yeah, the opiates are what nearly, I always say opiates stole everything from me, but benzos are what nearly killed me.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't understand, you know, there's so much talk about opiates that they don't understand the danger and the addictive qualities of the benzos and how dangerous detoxing from them are. I've had a number of clients recently, especially during the pandemic, that have had some real consequences coming off of opiate, trying to come off of the benzos themselves and not realizing how dangerous that is.
I can't tell you how many seizures I've had, and only by the grace of God, I wasn't driving when I had one and hurt somebody else. But, you know, that was part of my bottom, you know, in that summer of 2009 was, of course, every bottom I had a trap door, but still, it was the seizures that, and the boundaries that my family set for me that really got me to raise my hand.
Yeah. What about, you know, I was thinking about, you know, playing at center. I mean, getting your head whacked all the time, even, you know, just casually. I remember getting into treatment and they said, have you ever had a concussion? And I said, no, I don't think so. I know I've had my bell rung a few times, because that's what we used to call it, is you got your bell rung. And they said, well, describe that. And I said, well, you know, I'd get hit pretty hard or fall, you know, against the boards and hit my head. And I'd go to the bench and they'd give you some smelling salts. And then you go back on the ice. And they're like, well, yeah, those are concussions.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Hey, I got knocked out so bad one time up at the Silver Dome against Detroit. I walked off and sat on their bench. I didn't even know. And their team doctor sent me back into the game, you know? So, but, you know, again, I played in an era where head slaps were legal. You know, you could wrap up your forearms like Randy White used to do and make a club out of it, or Michael Carter for San Francisco, you know, and make a club out of your arm. And, you know, that was all legal back then. And, yeah, crap whacked out of us. And I think I had 20 documented concussions since high school. You know, all the way through, because, you know, eventually I had to go back and count them up and find records of them. But, you know, I'm quick with the athletes that I work with today. Families and athletes want to blame their behavior on concussions, on CTE. And to some extent, they might have a case. But since we can't diagnose CTE until postmortem, I'm quick to not let them do that. You know, I'm quick to not let them blame everything, their behaviors and everything else, on concussion, on head trauma, and things like that. And I could be wrong with that, but, you know, they'll never get the program. They'll never get sober if they blame everything on their head trauma.
Yeah. Well, and you and I both know that there's so much data coming out about the brain now that even if, you know, again, we can't diagnose the CTE, but so many athletes and people in general have head traumas. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean your brain can't heal and you can't make better decisions and change your behavior and all the things we know about a program of recovery and how much it can change your life and add to a healthy lifestyle. And you're right. I think a lot of people are quick to look for something to blame it on.
Right.
Look for the injury. Look for, you know, it was the doctor. It was the girlfriend that cheated on, whatever it is, instead of, you know, what we learn in treatment and in recovery is to start to take personal responsibility and start to look at the things that we can control and change about our lives. And, you know, we've both seen, you know, miracles, you know, we're two right here. I mean, I love to put up a picture side by side of you walking into treatment and me walking into treatment and say, you know, yeah, obviously pretty beat up, right? Yeah. And two guys that, you know, are fortunate to make a living trying to help families and people in recovery, speak at conferences, educate people that are probably a hell of a lot smarter than you and I are, Randy.
Oh, God. Definitely.
Overall, but don't know nearly what we know about this disease and, more importantly, the recovery from it.
I agree. And you've been a real blessing, man, knowing you. You've been a great role model for me. You know, how many years do you have now?
I'm coming up on 24.
Wow. See, you got what I want. And
yeah.
You've been a great role model, though, for not only me.
I appreciate that, and all I've done is what I was taught to do by the people that came before me. You know, people think that there's some complicated process to this, and we both know it's a lot of work. It's pretty simple. I mean, you know, there's some things we suggest: don't drink, you know, go to meetings, don't drug, you know, don't be a, I think I can say, don't be a dick. That's what I heard one of my first meetings.
Yes, you can.
Yeah, don't drink and don't be, you know what. And, you know, there's some real simple things that, you know, I think that the kind of public knowledge about this is starting to get there, but it's really just an introductory knowledge. You know, the benefits, you know, you talk about your wife, been with you through the thick and thin, and the difference in the relationship today and the blessing that is to be able to go through the fire together and get out the other side. Your children, grandchildren. I mean, who would have thought watching a two-year-old play with a ball could be so much fun?
Right,
you know?
Right.
I mean, I don't know about you, but before I got into recovery, the thought of having to spend a Sunday afternoon watching a little kid's show was just like, awful. And now it's one of my favorite things to do. So, you know, the ability to totally change the way we think and approach life. And in some respects, maybe just go back to what we learned as kids. I know that you grew up in Tyler, Texas, and you know, a church going lifestyle and values and all of those things that addiction kind of robs of us, to be able to, you know, come 360, so to speak, and be, you know, my favorite line I've ever heard was I was in treatment and this guy was speaking on the stage and he said, I think I finally became the man my dog always thought I was. And I thought, man, that's what I want to be. I want to be able to live up to that, you know? So, you know, we talked a little bit about the beating each other up. And again, I remember I fractured and dislocated my ankle junior year in high school. Literally, I got up to keep playing and my skate didn't touch the ice because my foot was sticking out to the side. And I still wanted to fight this guy, you know? And, you know, I think back about that mindset and how crazy that is. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of health and wellness and recovery and was it Keith Richards or something that said, you know, if I knew I was going to live this long, I would have taken better care of my body. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that's changed? You know, you're again going through the wars that you did in the trenches, you know, being a center and a pro football team. It's just a daily beating on the body. And then, you know, we're both 60 years old now. I mean, we're not spring chicken, and how that mindset has changed a little bit. For me, it's changed through my recovery. I mean, I wouldn't be able to take the steps I do if it wasn't for what I learned in treatment and in recovery. How has that impacted your life?
Well, I think it's important to stay moving. You know, when you quit moving, you start dying. And I think it's important to keep moving, whatever your interests are. But, you know, it's just kind of part of recovery. Recovery kind of makes you want to do that. You know, you've got this new life and this new opportunity. And, you know, back when we were in our addictions, we kind of lost interest in the things that we loved, you know, or we just didn't do them anymore. And so it's fun to be able to pick those things back up.
Sitting on the beach, one of my favorite things to do. I couldn't do that before I got into recovery. I had to be on the beach throwing a football or chasing a girl or doing something, always in motion. And that ability to just kind of sit on the beach like a beached whale and enjoy.
You know, I can think back, I think you can probably remember this too. You know, it even affected whether or not we went on vacations or went on trips. You know, did I have enough pills? I mean, I talk about being a prisoner to something. You know, it's just, it affected every decision that you made. And especially with me, because I was doctor shopping all over Houston, and you know, I had to go see a doctor, I had to go see a pharmacist, you know, and had all these different doctors and pharmacies all over town. And it just, it affected every decision that you made, is whether or not you had enough to get through whatever you were fixing to do.
Yeah, God forbid you be on vacation with your family and start to go into withdrawals. It probably curbed every decision you made. So I love this quote from your website. It says, over 20 years, God had plenty of opportunities to open the gates of heaven and let me in. What he chose to do was open the gates of hell and let me out. And I read that and I thought, that's awesome. That's perfect. Can you talk about that, what it was like? Because so many people, I think of it in this context, so many people think about, oh my God, I got found out. They're making me go to this treatment center. It's like all this negative self-talk and how awful this is. And you and I know this is like the opportunity. This is like winning the Super Bowl or something. I mean, it for me at least, it was, it is scary. And as much as I didn't want to do it on the way there, once I got there and the fog started to lift, I thought, man, why didn't somebody send me to this 20, 30 years ago?
I know.
Can you talk about that and how much that impacted your life?
Well, and I had a lot of consequences there at the end. You know, I didn't lose our last home or our home that we were in. This was in 2009, but I had to put it up for a short sale, and the new owners weren't going to take possession of it for another 90 days. So we moved the furniture out. I was having seizures practically every day as a result of withdrawal. My daughter wouldn't let me come around my first grandchild because I wouldn't fit to be around him. And my wife, she didn't leave me, but she couldn't stand to watch me continue to kill myself anymore. So she moved in with her parents. And I can remember, Michael, laying on the floor of our vacant house that we had just short sold. And furniture was all moved out. The utilities were turned off. And I can remember laying on the floor of that house thinking, you know, wow, I was a college All-American. I was a second-round pick of the Bucks. I was the 88 NFL Man of the Year. I married the greatest girl in the world. I've got two great kids. And here I am laying on the floor of a vacant house, living there with no job, no money, no car, and really no hope at that point. And, you know, my wife was willing to make one more call for me. And back then, they didn't have any resources out there for former NFL players. You know, this was back in 09. And she was willing to make one more call for me. And whoever she called that day in New York at the office on Park Avenue knew somebody who knew somebody. And that's how I got to BHOP that day to that treatment center. And that was September 22nd, 2009. But, you know, I fell out of that car when I pulled up there, and I had about another 30 or 40 feet to crawl to get through the door. And I crawled on all fours, and nobody helped me. And I'm glad they didn't, because, you know, that I kind of consider that my greatest accomplishment is crawling through the door that night. And listen, I think I'm a pretty tough guy. I've been in a lot of battles. You know, you don't get to stay in the NFL for 10 years unless you're winning most of them. But crawling through the door that night was the hardest thing. Like you said, that was the hardest thing that I ever did. But it was also the most rewarding. And, yeah, for many years, I thought I was the only one. And guilt and shame and pride and ego, what little pride and ego I had left, kept me from raising my hand, because, you know, I that warrior mentality where you suffer in silence, big boys don't cry. You know, you pick yourself up, you dust yourself off, and you get back in the huddle and you keep your mouth shut. That was that mentality that kept me out there for a long time. And really, I thought I was, first of all, I didn't want anybody to know, even though everybody already knew. And also, you know, I thought I was the only one out there that was suffering like this. And, you know, it wasn't until I stayed in treatment for 90 days. I had a knee replaced while I was in treatment. I had the other knee surgically worked on. I had some surgery on my neck. This was all while I was in treatment. And but it wasn't until I went off and started working on myself that I finally grieved the death of Randy Grimes, the football player, you know. I was still carrying around that guy. That was my whole identity. And I struggled with who am I now, you know, for so many years. How do I contribute? And, you know, when I wasn't Randy Grimes, the football player, I struggled at being an employee or a father or a husband or neighbor, because that was my whole identity.
So, yeah, and, you know, in mentioning that, you know, the loss of the self, the loss of trying to come to that acceptance of the loss of, you know, being at the height of a professional career like that, you know, can you tell me a little bit more about how you came to that realization that you were going to have to grieve that person and move on with the next chapter, if you will, of Randy's life?
Yeah. And it was about rediscovering myself, you know, and plugging into the passions that I used to have that I'd left behind all because of addiction. And, you know, I call it, and I don't know if this is an official term, but I call it transitional trauma, you know, and that's what I was struggled with. And I can remember when Sam Weiss put his hand on my shoulder and said, "We won't be needing your services here anymore." And I'd gotten hurt that year. Or halfway through that year, and I couldn't go try out for anybody else. I knew it was over. And I remember raking everything out of my locker into a black trash bag and walking out the back door. And I struggled with that for many years, you know, that it was over just that quick. I can remember thinking, wow, all the blood, sweat, and tears that I've left on football fields all over this country since fourth grade. And this is how it ends, you know, with a coach that has no loyalties to me. He's only been there a year, that I don't really like. And that's how it ends. And apparently it was. And, you know, the injuries just kept getting worse. The chronic pain just kept getting worse. My tolerance just kept getting higher. I needed more and more pills all the time. And the new normal in my life was ambulance rides and hospital stays and accidental overdoses and seizures and everything else. And I couldn't stop the chaos. And it was all because I couldn't really, well, I really couldn't find myself, you know. I lost myself when I didn't have that uniform to put on or that playbook to look at or that itinerary to go by. And you know, I really never knew that until I got in professional treatment. You know, somebody had to, Tori had to really drag that out of me. And she was a great therapist. She understood what I was going through. And looking back now, you know, with the guys that I work with, and regardless of what sport it is, and not just athletes, but veterans and first responders and to some extent, people that retire from their occupation and not what they thought it would be, you know, that transition. We as Americans don't do good with change, and transition is hard.
Yeah. No, even people that work, even people work in this field. I mean, I always laugh because we make a living trying to help people change, but then someone asks us to change and we're very reluctant to it still, you know. But I love that term transitional trauma because it's a good word for what you described just now that I've seen a lot of, you know, and I think it starts with that, especially for athletes, as you said, also veterans and a lot of different people, the surrender to win. Like, I remember hearing that in treatment the first time, and I thought, what in the heck are they talking about? Because as you said, you don't surrender, you know, you never let them see you sweat. I didn't even know what feelings were. I mean, growing up, you know, where I grew up and, you know, playing a contact sport that became my be all and end all. I remember sitting in group therapy and they said, you know, it's feelings check. And they went around the room and people said words and I said a word and they said, that's not a feeling. I said another word and they said, well, that's not a feeling either. And somebody gave me that feelings chart and I had to carry that thing around for about 2 years so I could start to identify what feelings were. Cause I, you know, my buddy, Stephen Brennan, you know, lost him to the disease about 5 years ago now, you know, great friend of mine growing up, tough plumber's kid, you know, Irish plumber from Boston. And Stephen used to say, you know, don't hurt my feeling, singular. And, you know, and then get to that point, surrender. And then they go, you know, who are you? And, you know, like you described, I don't know. You know, you had to find out who Randy was. I had to find out. I literally, a therapist had me look in the mirror 3 times a day and just say, you're enough. I'm enough. And I said, how long do I have to do this? And she said, until you believe it.
Oh, wow.
And you know, and it was kind of that rebuilding of, you know, grieving the past and putting that to bed, so to speak, that, you know, the loss.
Well, and it really is like a death, you know?
Yeah. 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 Death and a rebirth. And again, I know you're a man of faith and I am. I grew up in the church, but I wouldn't have described myself as a man of faith before I got into recovery. But I've learned a lot about spirituality and recovery. You know, you and your wife working together, I mean, that's just got to be such hope for people when they walk in. And, you know, again, seeing one of us is great, but seeing your wife there with you and being able to tell that other side of it, you know, I look at that as a spiritual opportunity, you know, to give a family, as you said, getting the family well is the goal for us. It's not the identified patient, it's the family. And, you know, how awesome is it that you guys get to do that stuff together?
Well, she'll be the first to tell you that she wanted to leave me. But God wouldn't allow her to. She'll be the first to say, you know, that God always told her that he was going to heal our family. And she hung in there based on that. And, you know, she's the real hero of my story. Her, my daughter, my son, because they're the ones that had to live with it every day. And they're the ones that never gave up. You know, eventually they learned to set healthy boundaries. And that's what got my attention. You know, that's the one thing that all addicts and alcoholics respond to is consequences. And that really got my attention. But to have her with me now, she's so good at working with families because she lived in that nightmare for so long. And she's good about telling people what she should have done. And by doing that, you know, she's telling people what to do now. And I mean, because she lived it and she was there for every bit of it. And it's funny how when we wrote the book, my stories didn't match up with hers, you know.
Yeah.
I remembered it a little different way than she did, you know. So it was good to have her as a part of that and to have my whole family have a platform in the book because it was a healing process for all of us.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because people, you know, a lot of times will ask me how I'm doing, and I'll say, if you really want to know how I'm doing, ask my wife. Because I can still lie to myself, and she can tell me the truth, you know. And again, having such a blessing to have a partner who's also on this road to recovery for me has been invaluable. You know, a lot of growth, a lot of healing, and we, you know, we get to travel and share that story with others. I look at this as truly as a gift. Again, you know, to be able to walk through the addiction, come out the other side, and really understand that, you know, God had a hand in it the whole way. I mean, I love that quote. I forget the pamphlet it was in, but it's, you know, the guy's in the river and he's going down. He's going to go off the thing and drown. And he grabs onto a rock and somebody throws him a rope and he says, no, I'm waiting for God to save me. And then a rowboat comes by and they throw him a life preserver. And he says, no, I'm waiting for God to save me. And then a helicopter drops a ladder and he's like, I'm waiting for God to save me. And then he gets exhausted. He lets go of the rock and goes down the river and drowns. And he's up in talking to St. Peter. He said, why did God forsake me? He said, what are you talking about? He sent a rope, a boat, and a helicopter. <You know? laughs> And I look at that, you know, as you said, got in a lot of trouble before you got into recovery. And I certainly was in a pickle when I walked through the doors of a treatment center. And I look back now that God had a plan in all of that. I mean, it was such a blessing to be able to go through the pits of that fire and come out the other side with a whole new lease on life, to me made it all worth it. You know, I wouldn't wish the pain of that addiction on anyone, but I want people to understand the hope on the other side of that, that you and I both know every morning when we wake up. Tell me a little bit more about the book. You know, you talked about your wife being able to be a part of it and your kids and, you know, and the families and to show the family recovery, not just the disease. And again, I love talking about the recovery. We all have stories. Everybody comes here through, you know, the trials and tribulations that go along with addiction. But the hope of coming out the other side of recovery and to be able to share that with your family, that's the stuff that really excites me. And I'm looking forward to reading the rest of the book.
Well, and I wanted to document everything that I'd been talking about all these years. You know, I'm coming up on 13 years in September, and you know, this was I started this project back before year 10, and I thought it was time. It's been a 3-year labor of love. COVID kind of slowed it down for a little while, and then we picked it back up about 6 months ago, and we finally completed it. And you know, it was just an opportunity for us to pour our hearts out into 234 pages.
Cool. Well, I will tell people out there that I listen to books these days because I'm a lazy reader, but I did buy Randy's book. before it went on Audible or any of that. And I am reading it. I'm on, I think, the fourth chapter now. So if I can do it, you can do it. I love the fact that you're out there. As you said, you know, when you were looking for help and your wife reached out, these services were harder to find. And, you know, I know you were out at the Super Bowl week, and I know that each person that sees you in a place like that can see the hope of recovery instead of seeing the pain of addiction. And I think the more we shine a light on that hope of recovery, the more people are going to maybe reach out and try this way of life, because it is an unbelievable way of life. Thank you again for coming on the show. To our listeners, you know the drill. Leave me a review and let us know what your thoughts are about the episode. Randy Grimes, Off Center. You can get it on Amazon. I got it the same day I ordered it. So don't be afraid to grab your computer, go out there. You may just save a life by reading this book. Randy, great to see you, my friend. I appreciate you coming on, and I look forward to seeing you soon. The Landmark Recovery Podcast is a production of Landmark Recovery, a rapidly growing network of substance use disorder treatment centers providing high quality and affordable clinical care. With the mission to unlock human potential, Landmark is committed to helping individuals live beyond their addictions. To learn more about our treatment options and our locations across the U.S., visit landmarkrecovery.com and follow us on social media at Landmark Recovery.